At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello from the Hill Country of Texas. I'm Jenna with Smarter News, and I have a confession to make. I was really surprised and quite frankly a little embarrassed to learn something about American history that I thought was true, but found out might not be. So let me give you a little bit of a background on this. My mother is first generation Italian American, and she has this amazing print framed in the home I grew up in San Francisco. And the print shows Betsy Ross sewing what's believed to be the first American flag. And I love this picture. It's beautiful. You can see Betsy sitting there on what looks to be a rocking chair sewing this flag with 13 stars representing the 13 colonies. And what's cool about this print in our home is that it's not far away from the trunk that my mother has, that her grandmother carried with her and my mother's father when they sailed from Italy to America. So in one room, there's sort of this interesting blend of old and new patriotism. You have the picture showing America at the beginning of American history, and then you have this artifact from our family that speaks to our family story about coming to America. But a few weeks ago, when I was doing some research for Flag Day, I found out that it's really not certain that Betsy Ross sewed the first American flag. She did live in Philadelphia, where the Continental Congress met. She did have a background that would fit with the legend that she sewed the first flag. Her family had an upholstery business, so sewing would be something she would know how to do. But there's just very little evidence. In fact, there's no historic documentation that proves that she's the one that sewed the very first flag. She might be. She might have done it. But it also might not be true. And this sort of rocked my world a little bit because I grew up looking at this print of this one, Betsy Ross, sewing this beautiful flag. So I dug a little bit deeper. And what I found is that the American flag as we know it really became more prevalent after the War of 1812, not the American Revolution. And a lot of that has to do with the national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. The Star-Spangled Banner, the flag that flew over Fort McHenry in Baltimore while Francis Scott Key wrote the famous poem that later became the national anthem of the United States of America. What I didn't know is that the original flag that flew that day, that Francis Scott Key saw, actually still exists, and it's preserved at the Smithsonian for us all to see. So I had to learn a little bit more about all of this. Jennifer Jones is the curator for the Star-Spangled Banner at the Smithsonian, and she shared some amazing insights about the making of the flag and the fight to preserve it. Shannon McLucas is a park ranger at Fort McHenry, and she also shared some fascinating insight about the historical context for the making of our flag and the writing of the poem that later became the national anthem as we know it. I loved interviewing both of these experts, not just because I learned a lot about American history that I probably should have known already, but I loved their take as well about what they've learned about America and what we should all reflect on during a time when we celebrate our nation, but also have these constant debates in the news about what defines America now and what will define America in the future. I hope you enjoy these conversations as much as I did. Let's start with Shannon McLucas, park ranger at Fort McHenry. Why is the flag that flew over Fort McHenry something every American should know about?
Well, it's actually the flag itself, when we think about how popular it is in American culture, it all goes back to the original flag at Fort McHenry. Before 1814, the flag didn't hold the same power and emotional resonance that it does now, because we're so accustomed to seeing it everywhere. It's a ubiquitous symbol of American cultural identity, but that didn't exist before 1814. It was more an official symbol that indicates, you know, an American ship or an American military garrison, but it wasn't something that people felt a personal connection to. And I mean, part of the evidence of that is that during the War of 1812, there were actually 18 states in the Union. There are only 15 represented on the Star-Spangled Banner. So if you get a chance to go down to the Smithsonian and see the original flag that flew over Fort McHenry after that bombardment, you're connecting yourself with that first generation of defenders who, you know, upheld the republic that was created during the Revolution. This weekend, or we're going to be, you know, this July 4th, of course, we're going to be celebrating the legacy of the founders by reciting sharing with visitors the Declaration of Independence. But with the War of 1812 at Fort McHenry, we talk about how the sort of the American identity starts developing through the flag, but also through the song that gains popularity, you know, the song, the Star-Spangled Banner.
There are so many different parts of this story that I'm a little bit ashamed that I didn't know more about, and I'll maybe take them in a few different pieces. Let's start with the flag itself. Tell us about Mary Pickersgill, because I've never heard her name before, and I can't believe that's the case, Shannon. I'm a little embarrassed about that, but tell me why she's so important to this story overall.
Well, actually, Mary Young Pickersgill, I know her name isn't famous. It's a little more well-known here in Baltimore, but what's really remarkable about her is two things, because she has a legacy beyond the Star-Spangled Banner. But, you know, beginning with that, she's best known as a flag maker who made not only the garrison flag that you can see at the Smithsonian, but she also made a storm flag, the one that flew over Fort McHenry throughout the bombardment in 1814. But if we look at her and her life and career, in 1813, she's 37 years old. She's the head of her household. She supports her daughter, Caroline, who's about 13 years old, as well as her mother, Rebecca Young, who was a flag maker in Philadelphia during the American Revolution. But Mary, when we think about her in 1813, she is a single mom and an independent businesswoman. And she receives a contract from the Army to make those two flags. So when we look at her life, when we think about it in terms of, you know, women's history and how we look at the empowerment of women over time, she's a great example because, you know, she gains a little more popularity and, of course, some more business with this particular assignment. But even before the Star-Spangled Banner, she stands out as a woman who is accomplished in her life. And by being the head of her household, by owning property in 1813, and owning her own business, it's really something in and of itself.
Would she have also been worried about her own, not only her livelihood, but her life, considering the sort of battles that were taking place at the time?
Very much so. Mary's house is still actually available for people to see. The Star-Spangled Banner flag house is just off Pratt Street in Baltimore. So you can go there. You know, if you visit Fort McHenry, you can also go to the flag house, which isn't too far away. And if you look across the harbor, you know, you can see kind of where Fort McHenry is located. So if you imagine the Royal Navy headed towards the center of Baltimore, if you imagine the British Army just on the eastern edge of town, and this is coming just a couple weeks after the burning of Washington and within a year of the burning of several towns and farms throughout the Chesapeake region, Mary would have been considerably concerned about her personal safety and that, of course, of her mother and daughter and two nieces who helped her make the flag, because there are 50,000 residents in Baltimore whose lives and livelihoods are very much threatened by the presence of the Royal Navy and the British Army in the Chesapeake.
And why was she chosen? Why was she recruited for this particular job?
Well, she's well known as a flag maker in that area. It's worth pointing out that she is, you know, she is a female flag maker, and they weren't all women. There are actually a lot of men in the same business. Baltimore being a shipbuilding town and a major port city, there are a lot of signal flags, a lot of flags for ships to be made, and then also, of course, some colors and things for the military. She knew some people in the military already. Colonel Benjamin Flower was a family friend, And so she had already made some colors for the U.S. Army. And so based on that, she already has a connection to the U.S. Army, and they find her and award her this particular contract.
And they give her a very specific request for the flag, right? That they wanted it to be a gigantic American flag.
They did. George Armistead in 1813, when he assumes command of Fort McHenry, and keep in mind, during this period, the Royal Navy is already in the Chesapeake. They're already terrorizing Marylanders and Virginians. And so when George Armistead is assigned there, he knows full well that there's likely going to be a battle in Baltimore. And he knows that city's threatened. And so he's tasked with preparing the fort. And that's going to include a lot of different things. But one of the requests he has is to have a garrison flag and a storm flag made. And the garrison flag, he wanted to be so large the British would have no difficulty seeing it at a distance. And the idea behind that was that it would raise the morale of his men serving there, but also it would be a signal to the Royal Navy if they approached the city of Baltimore. If you see a 30 by 42 foot flag, today people can see ours flying. When we're flying it, they can see it. Even with all the tall construction behind us, you can still, if you're driving down I-95, you can't mistake the garrison flag at Fort McHenry. and so in 1813, 1814, if you were sailing toward Baltimore, you would see it very clearly. And the signal that he's sending is that his garrison stood ready to defend that city. So he asked for one that's 30 by 42 feet. And of course, it's made based on the design for the flag as of 1795. So the stars, there are 15 stars and 15 stripes, one for each of the states in the Union as of 1795. So that would include the first 13 plus Vermont and Kentucky. And then Mary chooses to create that spangled effect on the blue field by tilting the stars to the right and left. And she makes it out of English wool bunting, which happened to be available. And she makes the stars out of cotton. They're actually reverse appliqued onto the flag. So they're stitched on one side, and then if you flipped over the blue field, you'd cut them out from behind, which actually saves some money in terms of buying material. you think about it, if you're a businesswoman, you want to cut the overhead as much as possible. So she makes two flags like that. One is a 17 by 25 that'll fly in bad weather, hence the name storm flag. And so those are the two he requests. She makes them, according to those specifications. She gets about just over $500 for their efforts. And if you go to the Star Spangled Banner Flag House, not only do they have some really interesting artifacts from her lifetime, they also have the receipt. So unlike with Betsy Ross, but it's documentation. Historians are always interested in documentation because that's how we know what came before us. And so at the Flag House, they have that. They have the receipt from the U.S. Army, and it has the details about the Star Spangled Banner before it was called that. So they have that document saying that Mary Young Pickersgill made this flag. So we have evidence, which is very important to historians.
And it is, as you point out, the documentation is key. The amount of money was significant. Wasn't it, Shannon, for that time in history? I mean, almost $500 is a lot of money.
Yeah, that's a tidy sum. But if you think about the amount of effort that goes into making this, it's kind of a large endeavor with 30 by 42 feet of fabric. That's a lot of stitching, and the turnaround time for this particular request was 6 weeks. So with the help of her daughter, Caroline, and with two of her nieces, all of whom were about 13 and 14 years of age, these young ladies were learning the art of flag making. And there was a young African-American indentured servant named Grace Wisher, who was also learning the art of flag making. She helped to sew the Star Spangled Banner. And the stitches are fairly small. If you go to the Smithsonian, you can see them. So if you imagine, stitching this throughout the day and then into the night to try and meet that deadline, that's a pretty good price.
Yeah, I guess so. You're right. It's hard to know because I've never stitched a flag, and I wouldn't have any idea how much work that would take. I did read something. I was curious if this was true. I read that the flag at some point was so big. I mean, you have to imagine it was bigger than a room of the house at the time, that they had to move across the street to a brewery to like lay it out. Is that true, Shannon?
That's true. If you see her house, it's kind of the quintessential Baltimore row home. And you know that you can't fit a flag in the front room of one of those buildings. So they do create some pieces of it, but to actually lay out the full flag, they take it to a local malt house and take it upstairs to lay it out on a large open floor. Nowadays, if when we're flying our flag, it takes up most of our parade ground. So you can imagine how much material you're working with there. But yeah, it's true. They actually laid it out at a brewery.
There's something seemingly very American about that too. I'm not exactly sure. There's something I really enjoyed about that fact. So, okay, let me leave the flag for just a second and let's talk about the Battle of 1812, because that's also a piece of American history that I feel like we all know about, but don't necessarily understand the significance of it. So talk to us about why were we, you know, so few years later after the American Revolution fighting with the British again, and what was at stake?
Well, one of the things to think about is there's a much larger perspective, and there's the context of the Napoleonic Wars, because after the American Revolution, there follows the French Revolution, and that's going to lead to a global conflict. The Napoleonic Wars between France and Great Britain, they're going to span the globe. They will stretch out to all the oceans and across the European continent, and that's going to affect the United States in the following ways. We're you know, just developing as a nation there. We're in our adolescence, went in 1802, 1803, as we proceed into the early 19th century. We're trying to develop our markets. And so the idea behind that would be, well, trading with whatever nation wants to buy the goods we have available. But what we encounter is that if we want to say, if you're a Baltimore merchant and you'd like to send a ship of goods to Marseille, you know, in France, you're going to run into some problems, because there are restrictions and different pieces of legislation passed by Parliament in Great Britain that will restrict U.S. trade. So because you're trying to trade with France, the Royal Navy would see your merchant vessel as it would be subject to seizure because you're aiding their enemy. And so too with France, you know, if we tried to trade with Great Britain, then our ships would be in danger. And this is at a time when we don't have a substantial navy at all. We have around 17 ships in the fleet, so we can't patrol our own shipping lanes. The other problem we run into is that during the Napoleonic Wars, there's a very high level or high rate of desertion among Royal Navy sailors. So what we find is that the Admiralty says that their policy is to go out and reclaim these deserters, but what they end up doing in practice is boarding American ships and saying, well, you know, you three sailors are deserters. When in point of fact, they weren't necessarily deserters. Many of them were American citizens, some natural born American citizens, some who had been naturalized as American citizens and were not involved with the Royal Navy, but they would find themselves pressed into service. And over the course of the Napoleonic Wars, there were about 10,000 American sailors who were forced into the Royal Navy against their will. So this brings up the question of U.S. sovereignty and what it actually means. As a new nation, we are viewed by many of the European powers as this experiment in republicanism that is not likely to thrive. And so the idea of these other nations, these more established nations, respecting American sovereignty and respecting the rights of sailors at sea, who are, you know, who are American citizens, it really comes to a head with the Congress at that point. And when you think about it, for a merchant in Baltimore, if he sends out a ship and he doesn't know if his goods are going to make it to port, and he doesn't know if his sailors are going to come back, and he doesn't know if his ship's going to come back, his insurance rates are skyrocketing and the cost of doing business goes up. And so that's going to really affect the livelihoods of people in port cities like Baltimore. So for free trade and sailors' rights is what really pushes the War of 1812, when it's declared in June of 1812.
So what I'm really hearing is that is that the American dream is under assault, right? If you cannot pursue your livelihood in a way that is sustainable in the economy, and that's under threat, then I don't want to say you have no choice but to fight. But this was the part of the calculation, wasn't it? To make sure that you maintain the freedom of the seas that also allows you to pursue your dreams. Is that a fair summary of kind of the setting behind all of this?
Yeah, that's one way you could put it, is that for Americans in that time, if they're, you know, if they're working as merchants or sailors, or even if they're the people who manufacture whatever goods we are trying to send to market or send overseas, yeah, these policies and the practices of the Royal Navy at that point in time do threaten their, you know, they threaten their livelihoods. And it's affecting the U.S., you know, how we're able to develop because our trade's restricted. And what we start to learn over the course of the War of 1812 is that we do need a Navy to protect our shipping lanes, and investing in the Navy and its mission is a worthwhile cause. But it takes us a little learning. I said it's the adolescence of the United States. It's when we have our own sovereignty, but we really have to figure out what that means and how the rest of the world can, you know, can respect that sovereignty. So it's actually a controversial war when it's developed. It's not particularly popular in the United States. It has some regional popularity, but it's for Americans at the time when we declare that war, it's perhaps ill-advised, given how ill-prepared we are for it. But there is a sentiment among Congress, the more hawkish Congress at that point, and that early American generation, that the U.S. should be respected overseas.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. So the scene sort of coming together. You have, as you put it, and it's really important to point out that there's conflicts around the world. Mm-hmm. If you're in America, you're hearing about it. You have our military, our infant military, trying to prepare for battle. You have the citizens of the United States, including Mary, who is sewing this flag, worried. There's no guarantee that America is going to stand in this very new nation that now we've just had, you know, really a few years under our belts as an independent country. And so here's the setting for Francis Scott Key to also kind of enter the picture. So at this point, when the flag is raised and the battle starts happening in Baltimore, Shannon, mm-hmm. talk to us a little bit about Francis Scott Key and how he kind of comes into this story that all together creates the national anthem as we know it.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it's one of the most frequently asked questions from our visitors is, what was Key doing there in the first place? And you've come to the same question, because Key is a 34-year-old lawyer from Georgetown. He did serve in the militia at the Battle of Bladensburg, but he comes to Baltimore because he was on a mission to secure the release of Dr. William Beans, who is a physician in Upper Marlboro down in Prince George's County. He had been taken captive by General Ross as his troops left the burning of Washington. So when they're going from Washington down to Benedict to board their troop ships, Dr. Beans interferes with their comings and goings and actually arrests a few of Ross's men. So Ross places him under arrest. And so Key is sent out with Colonel John Skinner, a U.S. agent, to secure Beans's release. And they do that. But whilst aboard the British ships, they realize, hey, wait a minute, they're turning to Baltimore. And so with Key knowing a little bit too much for his own good, he finds himself at the wrong place at the wrong time. And so he's detained aboard his own ship, but accompanied by some Royal Marines. He's detained while the British make their advance to Baltimore. And so when they arrive on September 11th of 1814, the British ground troops make their assault and head toward North Point, where they push the American infantry back to Hampstead Hill, which now, if you go to Patterson Park, you're standing on that ground where 15,000 Americans stood looking down toward 3,700 British troops. And so on the next day, Key is not far beyond the command ship as the squadron moves up the Patapsco toward Fort McHenry. And as you mentioned, the environment he's in, he also reads the papers. And the Royal Navy had been in the Chesapeake since the spring of 1813 and destroyed several small towns throughout that time. So Key knows full well what's going to happen to Baltimore should the British be successful, because the other thing to keep in mind is that Baltimore at that point is the third largest city in the United States. So this would have been quite a feather in the cap for Admiral Cochrane, British commander, should he be able to destroy Baltimore. So Key's watching that with a great deal of anxiety, and he's watching from the ship. He's looking back toward the bombardment of his countrymen for 25 hours, and that anxiety does well up, and then around 7 o'clock when the firing stops, there's the question that hangs in the air, just as the smoke from the bombardment does, of what has happened to the defenders and what is the fate of Fort McHenry, and with it, of course, the fate of Baltimore. And so at 9 o'clock, there's a single shot that pierces that silence, and that's when the storm flag is brought down. The storm flag had been flying throughout the night. And that flag is brought down, and as the field musicians at Fort McHenry gather on the parade ground, they play the tune Yankee Doodle, which was then the most popular, and they raise up the garrison flag, that 30 by 42 foot flag. And Key sees that, and when we think about the first lines of his poem, it's, "Oh, say, can you see?" By the dawn's early light. And he's looking back, asking a question in the first stanza, saying, can you see the flag that was flying last night? And so when he writes this, he has a great deal of anxiety. And then in the second verse, there's a sense of relief, realizing that with the garrison flag flying, it's signaling that Fort McHenry still stands and that its defenders are still ready to protect the city of Baltimore. So Key's song is inspired by the defiance, the resilience, the determination of those defenders who served at Fort McHenry. And what's interesting about that is that the song, if you read all the lyrics, nowhere does it say Baltimore or Fort McHenry in it. But the song travels all the way up to New Hampshire and down to Georgia within the space of about 3 weeks. And this is pre-tweeting, so it moves pretty fast, just by word of mouth. And you know, he wasn't an artist, you know, and then of course you couldn't take a star-spangled selfie, but he gives us an image of that battle and its aftermath. And in doing that, he also gives us an image of the defenders, because in the fourth verse he says, "And thus be it ever when freemen shall stand between their loved homes and the war's desolation." So as people throughout the early republic hear that, you know, people in Philadelphia where they could hear the bombardment think that, you know, they would put themselves in that position. As far up as you know, up in New Hampshire and Vermont, if you go down to, say, Savannah or Charleston, where they feel when they hear that song, if their city was threatened, that they would place themselves between their loved homes and the war's desolation. So it becomes an aspirational song as it gains popularity. It gives a boost to morale in the early republic at a time when it was most needed.
There's so many different parts of that story that are, they're so fascinating. Did I hear you correctly that the battle at Fort McHenry, or moving towards Fort McHenry, started on September 11th?
Yes, the British arrive in the Patapsco River on the 11th, and Baltimore had been preparing for this moment. Baltimoreans had prepared defenses along the eastern border of the city. They made sure that Fort McHenry was well supplied. There were several other batteries that stood ready to protect the city. And on the 11th, it's actually a Sunday morning, and there were folks throughout Baltimore who were attending church, and they hear the signal that indicated the British fleet had arrived in the Patapsco River. So no longer were they, you know, in the bay. They were now in the Patapsco River, which is a tidal estuary of the bay. So they're very near town. And when that signal rings out throughout town, you know, pulpit folios are closed and benedictions are pronounced and everyone goes to their stations. So, you know, when we think about that date, naturally, you know, with people of my generation, that date has a very powerful meaning. And when we think about a community really coming together and acting, you know, feeling a community that feels threatened and really pulling itself together and taking action for the common good. In Baltimore in 1814, you have men going to their posts, you have women looking after their families, you have everyone doing what they can to protect their community. That has a great deal of resonance with us today when we think about that day in 2001, because the symbolism there, you can't help but draw these parallels of it's another time when a community comes together and says, what can I do? Which is a great way of looking at you know, an enduring American spirit of how can I help my community. And another great connection there is the image of the flag, because when we think of 1814, of course, it's the Star Spangled Banner being raised over Fort McHenry in defiance, in showing that determination for community that will stand. And so too in 2001, when we think of the image of the Star Spangled Banner now with 50 stars being flown over the rubble in New York and after 9/11.
Wow. That's remarkable. I didn't know that. And that you're right. The parallels of just thinking about those two dates. It's one, obviously September 11th, but two different times in American history, and the parallels between the people is really something. It's really powerful. The other thing that you mentioned was, and I think this is so important, because obviously now we sort of sing the national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, and don't really think about the punctuation because we don't, you know, we're not, you know, writing it down all the time. We're just sort of singing it, and we only really sing the first stanza, and it's the question mark in that stanza, the home of the brave, that we declare at the end of when we sing it, but really is a question mark at the time. And then as you go through the poem, the question mark disappears. But I think that's sort of interesting, Shannon, that we don't raise the question at the end of the anthem anymore. And I was curious, at the time, was the national anthem, was it, you know, sung or read completely as the four stanza poem it is, or at different points in history, or are we sort of just taking out the first stanza and that's the most popular and that's why it's lasted all these years? Can you just tell us a little bit about how that's evolved?
Oh, sure. Well, when it first gains popularity, you know, it's a song. The words of it are set to a familiar tune called To an Acreon in Heaven, which is actually a British song. But this is, of course, pre-copyright. So there are a lot of songs that are placed to tunes that are already familiar. So that song, when it's first... It's first performed in Baltimore on the 19th, and then it gains popularity when you think, you know, pubs and coffee houses throughout the early Republic, and they would sing all four verses. So they would traditionally sing all four verses of it. The song becomes more formalized as it becomes, you know, when it starts to be played at public occasions, but it's still never a national anthem until 1931. It's never made an official anthem. There are several popular patriotic airs that come about during the 19th and early 20th century. But the Star Spangled Banner it endures throughout those time periods. And then once it's kind of pared down, John Philip Sousa establishes a formalized version for kind of this is how the song is meant to be played, which is the version we use to this day. And that's adopted by the military. Now, of course, you know, now we tend to sing, yes, just the first verse, but everyone has their own take on it. A lot of different performers will have a little different style. If you come to Fort McHenry, we have several recordings that give you this, you know, the impression of how it's been played by, you know, Jimi Hendrix, Marvin Gaye, Whitney Houston, all these different varieties, the U.S. Marine Band. and you'll hear there's a great amount of difference in style, but the meaning is still there. And the fact that in the United States, you can take something as important as our national anthem and still give it your own personal sort of interpretation, is really an interesting thing. It's a great way to express that we can still take this very formal song and we have the freedom of expression to make it our own.
Absolutely. It's making me think, and it kind of leads us to a final question here. When we think about American independence, we think about probably a few things, pretty obviously, the national anthem and the flag and the American Revolution. But really, the national anthem and the American flag as we know it really was the byproduct of the Battle of 1812, and specifically the War of 1812, and in this particular battle in 1814, that some believe really secured America's independence in a significant way that got us to that next step as a nation. Can you just talk to us about the significance of that moment where we realize that we have survived this attack by the British, we do have this national anthem, the flag is still flying. How does this sort of set the tone for the America as we know it today?
Well, the War of 1812 is actually, it's a great lesson for us as we develop as a nation. As I mentioned, you have sovereignty and independence established with the revolutionary generation. And then the next question for the next generation is, what are you going to do with that? And the War of 1812 is a way where we begin to take our place on a world stage and figure out where we fit in there. Throughout the course of U.S. history, you know, we have westward expansion, and then we start to, each generation is going to take that, that a challenge with them. The War of 1812 is the first big challenge to what the next generation will do following the revolution and how the U.S. will unfold. As we get to the Civil War, of course, it's one of our greatest challenges as a nation is holding the Union together. The idea of building a more perfect Union is something, it's work that all of us continue to do. The Star Spangled Banner actually is very popular during the Civil War as well, when we're trying to hold the country together. And then as we move into the late 19th century, the early 20th century, our presence on the world stage becomes greater with the First World War, and then definitely into the Second World War, we start to gain a larger presence on the world stage as, you know, influencing different communities. But the United States, is a young nation when we think about international politics, and it's growing, and, you know, we have our own internal changes, and we have how we relate to other nations. And what's interesting when we think about the message of the Star Spangled Banner is that it shows that we as a community, these defenders that Key writes about, and that they come from different walks of life, that we as a community can come together and serve a common purpose when we need to, and that the flag represents that kind of determination and that community spirit that's exhibited by the defenders in 1814. And one of the things the popularity of the Star Spangled Banner can tell us is that that's timeless. That idea of an enduring American nation, because we weren't necessarily sure right after the Revolution how long this nation would endure, but it continues to. We face challenge after challenge, and we still manage to hang in there. And so the efforts of the defenders in 1814, you know, just in Baltimore, it sent us, you know, their story as it's told in the Star Spangled Banner is something that we can all relate to even in 2019.
Thank you to Shannon and the entire team at Fort McHenry who make sure we remember the past so we can better understand the present. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. We love sharing these stories with you, but we also love hearing from you as well. If you have any story ideas or feedback, you can email us info@smarternews.com or direct message us as well on social media. We read every single message. We love providing quick, concise, nonpartisan news for you on a regular basis. News when it matters and why it matters. A refuge from the storm. We are Smarter News. I'm Jenna. I hope you have a great day.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.